From Georgia Public Broadcasting, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought, a daily opportunity to hear the voices and issues of the South. If you keep it locked on GPB, Joshua Johnson hosts a national conversation, 1A at 10. Johnson launched the show in January of 2017 after longtime NPR host Diane Rehm retired. 1A has become a destination for brisk, smart, and always civil dialogue. And the unflappable Joshua Johnson, a well-loved host. 1A is going to be broadcasting out of GPB this Thursday and Friday. And tomorrow night, Joshua Johnson is moderating a panel on media ethics at our Atlanta Bureau. GPB's Leah Fleming worked with Johnson years ago at the Miami Herald and spoke with him about his intentions for 1A.
So when I was first hearing about this title, 1A, I was thinking about our days at the Miami Herald where it was like above the fold, top story, you know.
Right.
But that is not what this 1A is. What is it?
1A stands for the First Amendment, which we basically consider to be the essential rules of the road for how we engage with one another in a democracy. You know, free speech, a free press, freedom of worship, and then freedom to demand change from the government. It's basically the government saying that it is binding its own hands from preventing us from doing that. So since the First Amendment kind of deals with the way that we engage with one another, we thought that would be a good name to encompass these debates about who we are as a country. But also, from my time at the Miami Herald, which called its front page, page 1A, those are the kinds of stories that we're going after. Those front page stories that either everyone's talking about but would like to talk about more deeply, or stories that aren't like the big story of the day, but they say something about who we are. They reflect us back to ourselves, and they're worth talking about.
You mentioned free speech. And in this day and age, it does seem to be, many people would say, under attack in many ways, whether it is ballplayers taking a knee during the national anthem, or whether it's conservative speakers who feel like they are being blocked from college campuses. And I'm wondering, what have you been learning about the First Amendment and free speech?
I think free speech is actually doing pretty well these days, and part of that is because technology makes it so much harder to absolutely crack down on what someone can or cannot say. I mean, the First Amendment does not prevent, say, Facebook from setting rules on who can speak where. It deals with government, not with private enterprise. So I feel like a lot of people are actually learning what the law does and does not do. But at the same time, we're finding more affinities with people in new ways, and people's freedom of speech, their freedom of petition, has more power. I mean, look at movements like, say, the Me Too movement. That is entirely an outgrowth of social media. After Ronan Farrow published that article about Harvey Weinstein, that hashtag had tremendous power. So I feel like free speech is not really under attack. It's just we're feeling the visceral power of it so much more these days that it's hard to deal with. I mean, it's not always a comfortable thing to have people inveighing against the things you believe in or arguing with you in, you know, tweet storms, but it's not bad. It's just new, and we have to figure out how to do that in 2018. 1A is part of helping people figure that out.
Yeah, and I would think that part of figuring that out is coming to a place where you understand that perhaps there's a time to talk and perhaps there's a time to listen. And I'm wondering, have you discovered that on the show?
For sure. I've started to think of it as leadership through listening. Listening as a form of leading. It's hard to go into a conversation when you've got so much that you want to say. And I've been waiting for somebody to finally ask me the question so I can finally say what I've been thinking, because I've been wanting to tell you people what's on my mind for a very long time. And just ask me the question so I can say what I'm thinking. There's so much energy out there of so many people who are just dying to listen. But I think the fact that I come into this generally with no dog in the fight makes it easier for us to create space for others. I find that when you listen to someone, when you hear them out, it's almost like you let the air out of a balloon, right? It takes all the tension out, and then they can hear you. So 1A is designed to be that kind of a space. It's hard to listen when you are legitimately upset or scared or excited about something, and there's nothing wrong with that emotion. Our job is to make space for everyone to be who they are, to feel what they're feeling, to think what they're thinking. We'll be the ones who do the listening. you be the ones who do the talking, and then once you know you've been heard and represented, it's easier for you to listen to people who are different from you.
I know that the show has really sought to uncover what connects us as opposed to what divides us. And I'm wondering, what is the key for you to navigating all those sometimes difficult conversations?
Remembering that it's not about me. Remembering that when someone approaches you with anger, it's usually something about you that reflects them back to themselves, their own issues, their own stereotypes, their own hopes, their own misgivings. That's not personal. And that my responsibility is to try to make peace through the words that I say. You know, there's a Bible verse that says life and death are in the power of the tongue. And my job is to try to speak life, to try to speak peace, to try to speak understanding. Doesn't mean I always have to make it comfortable. I still have to ask incisive questions. But if I come into this with a desire for understanding and for connection, then everything I say has to be governed by that. You know, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Mm-hmm. So my job is to be very careful about what I say. Fortunately, if the show is mostly letting you speak as opposed to me, I don't have to worry that much because I can say less. I don't have to do all the talking. I just need to say the right thing to get the conversation going and then let you have the floor.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk personally for a moment. You are a black man and you are a gay man. And on public radio, that makes you a very unique voice that we haven't often heard from. And I'm wondering, does any of that inform the work that you do when you come into the studio every day?
Well, I think anyone who comes from any kind of a marginalized background knows what it feels like to be disdained or disrespected or just flat out dissed because of who or what you are. I don't care if you are black and gay like me or if you are a poor Southern white person from Appalachia or whether you are a new immigrant to the United States. You know, whatever you are, we know what it feels like to be an outsider, and we know how it feels to be put down and kept out. Because I know that, I can decide not to impute that on other people. I can decide that my journalism, my interviewing, will always be aimed at welcoming people. You know, it's part of that whole discussion about objectivity and impartiality. People ask, you know, how can you be objective and impartial when you talk about all these difficult issues? You know, I'm not as objective about, say, things like racism, but I can be clinical about it. I can view it for what it is. I can use it as an opportunity to learn, and then I can wash my hands of it and let it go. I can't be objective about racism, but I can be clinical in conversation with someone who, for example, believes that statues of Robert E. Lee should remain standing. You know, I can't be objective about sexism, but I can be clinical in conversation with a man who is rethinking his relationships with women. And because I know what racism and homophobia are like, I can choose not to put that kind of negative energy back on people who may express that. It can stop with me, and I can set the rules for this space and say, hey, you come on our show, you can't talk to our other guests like that. You got to treat them with respect. We brought you in with respect. You have to show that to everybody or you got to hit the bricks. So it gives me a platform to do more good than just a quick clapback. The clapback is satisfying for a moment, but it doesn't build a movement. And 1A is trying to build a movement where the nation decides everybody's welcome. And it's incumbent upon us to listen, even if we don't always like what we hear.
GPB is bringing your show to listeners in Georgia, which are pretty much standard in the sense that our listeners, they tend to be engaged and thirsty for that kind of conversation that you're describing. But there's also a uniqueness here in being a Southern state. And I'm wondering if that excites you when you think about talking to us in here in Georgia.
You know, I hate to break it to Georgians, but we've got a lot of love in Southern states already. I'm sorry you're not the first. I love that GPB is in now, but Birmingham, Alabama showed us big love early, early on in the life of 1A.
Oh, whatever.
The state of Florida rolled out for 1A early on. I'm not going to say, yeah. You took your time. You thought it through, you mulled it over,
right.
And you made a prudent decision. But I think one of the things that we really enjoy is being able to speak to many different parts of the country. I mean, we did an entire hour on Appalachia, mm-hmm. just on the concept of being Appalachian. We did an entire hour on just what's going on in the state of Kentucky. When we visited New Orleans, we did an hour on what's happening in New Orleans and Louisiana. We try to focus on these local needs. Maybe one day we'll make it to Georgia and we can talk in depth about what's going on in Savannah and Macon and Atlanta and elsewhere. So it's great to be able to have all these different parts of the country know that when they speak, we're actually listening and we're actually invested in this idea of civil conversation. Georgians are fantastic. I love Georgia. I'm from Florida. We spend a lot of time in Atlanta and Savannah mm-hmm. and elsewhere, but I feel like, you know, these conversations are already happening, including on GPB. We're not bringing you anything that is unprecedented. If you listen to GPB, you know that this is already what's done. We're just trying to add to that and to augment that. And if we can, then that's a gift. That's something we're proud of.
Yeah, that's what excites us. So I remember that you used to love network TV. So what drew you to public radio?
I was working in the newsroom of my hometown CBS station. Mm-hmm. I needed a job. I had a job right out of college writing a grant. The grant fell through, and so I came back home and was working in that newsroom. And I did it for a year and then got the opportunity to come work in public radio and ran screaming from local TV news because I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't spend my day sitting on the assignment desk looking at a bank of police scanners and listening for something to pop off so I could send a live truck. Like the idea of building my news day around waiting for something bad to happen to you felt low. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a very exploitive, nasty, puerile way to make a career, as opposed to actually talking about what's happening in the community, not just who got shot on the street, but about what's happening in the streets in a community sense. And public radio offered me a chance to hit the streets and not just wait for bodies to hit the street. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that there was a difference, I never looked back. I love television. I would do television at some point in the future. I still make appearances from time to time on, you know, Meet the Press and so on. But day to day, like you have to make choices about whether the work you do matches your values, whether or not you can go into the office and feel like you have to hold your nose to get through the day, or whether you feel like you're breathing fresh air 5 days a week. And I didn't want to keep holding my nose and be a journalist. And public radio allowed me not to have to do that.
Thank you so much, Joshua, for your time.
My pleasure, Leah. Thank you.
Joshua Johnson, host of NPR's 1A, speaking there with our GPB colleague, Leah Fleming. Tomorrow and Friday, Johnson and his team are broadcasting right here at our Atlanta Bureau. And tomorrow night, you can see him in action. He'll be moderating a panel on media ethics at GPB Atlanta at 7. So come join us. Details at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Governor Nathan Deal called a special session of the Georgia legislature for November 13th. Southwest Georgia was devastated by Hurricane Michael, and the governor's office told the AJC that the state needs to allocate about $100 million to help with the cleanup and support local governments. GPB's Grant Blankenship has more on the catastrophe that prompted the move.
Tucked away in a corner of the Pine Knoll Pecan Grove near the town of Pretoria, Georgia, is one of those things that Mitch Bulger says makes living and working here worth it.
I promise you, stick your finger in that, that's cold as water. There goes a duck.
A flock of about half a dozen water birds fly through cypress trees, bordering a bubbling spring-fed pool. And yes, this summer swimming hole is in fact cold.
Oh, wow.
A lot of fun back here.
Bolger's been the farm manager at Pine Knoll for 20 years. The family that owns the plantation is mostly scattered to Colorado and Rhode Island. But for Bolger, this is the only home his kids have ever known.
This means everything to me.
Which is why the scene at our backs hurts so much. It's one of the thousands of the farm's pecan trees laid low by Hurricane Michael. And this one was a real moneymaker.
One of the oldest varieties there is.
That's actually called a moneymaker.
That's actually called a moneymaker. Here's the biggest one, Grant, this one right here.
Its ripped up taproot is encased in red clay, and maybe 30 yards away, pecans are piled like gravel in a dry stream bed between enormous tree trunks. The nuts could still be gathered by hand if only someone would do the work.
I had a crew Monday, and now I don't have a crew, so I paid them 25 cents, they still didn't stay.
That's 25 cents a pound, and that works out to about $25 a day. In an average year, these nuts would have been headed to China. Not this year. And not because of the weather, but because of the U.S.-China trade war. Now?
I don't know that we can supply what our Americans would need.
There's still money to be made in a grove of far younger trees, though it didn't escape damage. Thousands of these trees must be cut down, too. Still, Bolger says the younger trees are the long-term future of the Pine Knoll Plantation. But in the short term?
Got those lean years coming ahead of us, and we'll work around them.
Mitch Bolger says that means replanting. And tending, and waiting for decades. Then he's hopeful he'll see the Pine Knoll Pecan Plantation thick with moneymakers again. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Pretoria, Georgia.
And the destruction that Grant reported on prompted Governor Deal to call lawmakers back to Atlanta. He's done this only once before to redraw congressional districts, and that was in 2011. Bill Nygut is host of GPB's Political Rewind and is here for some perspective on the assembly set to convene under the Gold Dome next month. Bill, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Virginia.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is a special session?
Under Georgia statutes, a governor is permitted to call the legislature back into session at a different time of the year than the regular session.
So it adjourned, what, in March?
They go from January to usually late March, early April. It depends on how many times they stop the clock. So that they have a 40-day annual session. Required by law. But then the governor, if he feels there's a pressing need, can call an additional meeting of the legislature. He has to, in his call, tell the people of the state, tell legislators what he wants on the agenda for that special session. He's done that in this case. He wants to look at hurricane damage and how to pay for it. He wants to look at a tax break for jet fuel, and he may have one or two other items that he'll add to it. I think he wants to get some judicial confirmations. He has a little leeway in deciding on a couple of additional items, but he also has to say, we think we'll go a week, we might go a little longer.
Right, and this is state lawmakers earn about $17,000 a year.
Yeah.
Many have other jobs. A practical barrier to calling a special session. So how extraordinary is this?
It happens irregularly, but it has happened on a number of occasions in the last few decades. And this one, the reason for it, of course, is that there has been at least $100 million worth of damage that the state and the federal government are going to have to deal with. Hurricane Michael was obviously incredibly devastating to farmers, to rural Georgia communities as well. And he doesn't want to wait to start figuring out how to pay for those bills. So he's bringing the legislature together first and foremost to address the costs and how to deal with them.
I'm reading 35,000 property-related insurance claims have been filed. Insured losses estimated to hit a total of $250 million. That's according to the Georgia Insurance Commissioner. Of course, insurance is different than federal funding. And this doesn't even cover Georgia crops. So by meeting earlier, what does that mean? The money gets out earlier?
Yeah. I mean, eventually, most of this will be paid for by federal relief dollars. But in the meantime, the governor and his people say, look, we got to start paying bills now. We've got to pay for maintenance crews who are going to do cleanup in a lot of these cases. We've got staff, people in government staffs who are working many overtime hours. And he wants to find a way to pay for this stuff now so the checks can start flowing. Federal aid will reimburse a lot of this later on.
We did speak to two farmers in southwest Georgia after Hurricane Michael. Here's what Irwin County pecan grower Randy Hudson said.
Well, I'm going to tell you, last year we lost over 1,000 trees to Irma. And at that time, I walked across orchards and I said, look, I don't know about this. But then I went back and planted those spots and counting on my grandchildren one day to harvest pecans. And, of course, this, now I'm out here today with probably at least another 1,000 trees on the ground. And just every acre I got has got just limbs piled on top of limbs.
It's just tragic to imagine a farmer looking out over their land like that. And farmers and others in southwest Georgia are certainly suffering. But is a special session the only way the state can help? I mean, does Governor Deal have any special powers he can exercise for emergency funding the way a president, for example, could use an executive order?
Well, I think one of the most important things that a governor can do is to make a special pleading with, in fact, the federal authorities, in this case with the President of the United States. It's very important. You know, there's a lot of controversy over whether people like or dislike the way President Trump is running his administration. But the fact that the governor was able to meet with Donald Trump in South Georgia and talk about the damage is an incalculably important opportunity to press for the kind of emergency relief that the people of rural Georgia are going to need. And it helps that we're a Republican state in this case. Donald Trump isn't going to respond as quickly if there's a disaster, say, in the heart of Illinois' Democratic territory or Massachusetts. He wouldn't necessarily ignore it entirely. But presidents do respond to the people in the states that he or she would know they support him or her.
Well, farmers and state and local officials that we talked to were effusive about the visits to the region by President Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and other top officials. But more on that. In his research, John Gasper, he's at Carnegie Mellon's B School, he found that disaster response have been political footballs played by Democrats and Republicans. How have we seen that play out?
Well, look no further than Puerto Rico. The president was very slow, as was FEMA, to respond to the devastation. Puerto Rico, as we know, was wiped out by the Hurricane Maria that went through there. And, you know, there's this sense that Puerto Rico is a distant kind of cousin to the United States. But in fact, the people of Puerto Rico vote in elections. They have a role to play in electing presidents. So the fact that the president seemed to be slow, and when he did finally go to Puerto Rico, there were people who felt that the way he behaved in Puerto Rico did not take into consideration the gravity of the situation, actually is having blowback in the midterm election year. There are many Puerto Ricans who have relocated to Florida because their homes are unlivable or they've got other issues that have not been resolved, and they will get to cast votes in November that could very well be referendums on how they feel Trump did in dealing with the Puerto Rican hurricane.
Right. Well, Randy said Irma was a devastating hurricane for Georgia, but there was no special session called then. And it's impossible to ignore the fact that midterm elections now less than 2 weeks away. Rural voters, hardest hit by Hurricane Michael, voters in counties that tend to vote Republican.
Yeah.
You know, Governor Deal's going to be a lame duck then when he calls this session. His successor should then be decided. Is there any political calculation in calling a special session?
Well, I haven't talked to the governor about this. I cannot read his mind, but it is certainly true that Brian Kemp is spending most of his time courting voters in rural areas of Georgia. He was very quick to get down to South Georgia to talk to the people there who were hit by the storm. So is that in the back of Governor Deal's mind? I would think that there may be something to what you're saying, Virginia.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I'm speaking with GPB's Bill Nygut about the special session of the Georgia legislature for hurricane relief. But When it does come to disaster response and declaration, we have to face it. There's a lot riding on that response for politicians. Giuliani was named America's mayor, yeah, we remember, after 9/11. Obama was criticized for his response to the oil spill, the Gulf, yes, oil spill, which was pretty slow. What are some other examples of how this has played out and changed an administration's legacy?
George W. Bush was criticized severely for the way that his administration responded to Katrina in New Orleans for a couple of reasons. Number one, you'll recall that after Katrina came through, President Bush was on Air Force One coming back from a trip. They happened to be in Louisiana airspace, so he asked that Air Force One fly low over New Orleans so that he could survey the damage. And the image of the president comfortably ensconced on Air Force One looking down on the devastation didn't play very well. And then when he made his first trip to the area, He commended his FEMA.
Oh, hell of a job, Brownie.
Brownie, yeah, you're doing a hell of a job, Brownie. And the backlash to that was particularly strong, clearly, among African Americans, some of whom felt he was at the very least insensitive to the needs of their people, but worst, showing a racism that some attributed to Bush throughout the rest of his tenure. Mm. It was made worse when his mother, Barbara Bush, went down and said, remember, the Superdome was used as an evacuation point.
Right.
People were staying in there. The conditions there were horrendous and were reported by many news organizations. And Barbara Bush said, well, these are underprivileged people anyway, so this really isn't so bad for them. Mm. That made things even worse.
Yeah. Well, next door in Florida, you mentioned that possibly the Puerto Rican voters are making a big difference there. But Florida Governor Rick Scott, he suspended his Senate campaign against, mm-hmm, Bill Nelson to deal with the devastation. We've also seen plenty of footage of gubernatorial candidates, the Democrat Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis on the ground, you know, with chainsaws,
sure,
helping to clear visiting sites. I am in no way discounting their motivation to respond. But is there a risk, Bill, in seeming opportunistic about dealing with these tragedies?
I think it all depends on attitude and the way in which the candidate approaches the work. Again, if President Trump goes to Puerto Rico and starts tossing paper towels to people sitting there, making a game of it, the reaction is, of course, negative. If a candidate goes in and can overcome the skepticism by appearing to be genuinely concerned, to connect in a very direct way with the people, then I think that makes all the difference in the world. Because isn't that really, aside from the aid that people can get, isn't what they really want is a human connection with their leader and a feeling that their leader is empathetic with what they're going through? That's the people who have embraced Donald Trump have embraced him for many reasons. But the bargain they've made is they have supported a guy who they know within his DNA, he just doesn't have that empathy gene, and he probably never will. And I think that's the reason he's criticized frequently. George W. Bush, remember, he made a disaster out of his reaction to Katrina. But when he stood at ground zero in the days after 9/11, he was at his best. He picked up the bullhorn. He said, America today is on bended knee in prayer for the people whose lives were lost here. He talked with such empathy, with such caring, that people, we needed that as Americans on that day.
Mm. Well, 2 weeks now, less than 2 weeks from a major election, with Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp running neck and neck for the gubernatorial race. And I know you'll be talking about that debate that was last night. How closely are voters looking at their responses to natural disasters like this?
Well, I mean, we haven't gotten a chance. I mean, as I said, both Kemp and Abrams have gone down to rural Georgia to show their concern about the disasters down there. But I wouldn't say that either of them have in any way showcased how they would respond in a major way in their campaigns. Again, Kemp, because he's working for those rural Georgia votes as a counterbalance to what he expects Abrams will get in metropolitan areas, he has a natural advantage as long as he conducts himself appropriately when he goes down there. And to the best of my knowledge, the reporting I've seen, he's done just fine.
Well, the debate was last night.
Yeah.
Wonder, you know, that was, let's say, contentious in its tone. We're about to wrap, but just any thoughts on polling? Any thoughts on, did it change any minds?
Well, the race is neck and neck. I don't think the debate last night changed any minds whatsoever, because both candidates pretty much stuck to the script they've been using throughout the campaign. And the question is, did either of them do enough to make sure they motivated the people who are already supporting them to get out and vote? We don't know that and won't until Election Day.
I guess you'll be talking about some of our October surprises that have recently come out today on Political Rewind. Bill Nigut, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Virginia.
Thank you so much. Bill will be breaking down last night's gubernatorial debate with his panel on Political Rewind. That's today at 2 here on GPB. Now, stay with us. We're going to hear from the creators of Accents. That's a new web series that embraces immigrant identity through accents. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you've never heard of Tina Clark, you've probably heard her work. Tina wrote songs and produced records for legendary musicians like Aretha Franklin, Chaka Khan, and Patti LaBelle. Tomorrow we're going to hear about her coming-of-age story in the South. Be sure to join us for that one. A foreign accent can invite intrigue, conversations, insensitive imitations, and stereotypes. One Atlanta group is working to debunk the stigma for immigrants. Accents is a web sitcom featuring 6 actors from different ethnic backgrounds. Here's a clip to give you a feel.
This is a nice surprise.
Yes, it is. I did not know that you had a secret boyfriend.
He's not my boyfriend.
He's her husband. I'm her husband.
Yes. No way. You are Niambri's secret hubby. Do you also have secret children?
Can we talk?
Yes, but not here. Let's go back to my place.
Right.
No.
Okay.
I mean, yes. Nigel, you cannot tell anyone about this.
The show's creator, Ignacio Vidal, joins me in the studio to talk about the show that's produced in Atlanta. Hello, Ignacio.
Hello, how you doing?
Very well. Also, Rita Omoshane and Shakeb Sikender are with us. They're both actors. Thank you so much for joining us. Rita, hello.
Hello, thank you for having us.
And glad you're here. Also, you, Shakeb.
Oh, I appreciate for you having us over here.
First time on radio, but you look really good. Let me just let the audience know that.
Thank you.
Now, all of you know firsthand what it's like to immigrate to the U.S. Where's everyone from? Shakeb, you want to start with you?
I'm originally from Afghanistan, but I grew up here all my life.
And how about you, Rita?
I'm actually from Nigeria, and I came here when I was 8 years old.
All right. And Ignacio?
I'm from Mexico City.
So why did you create the sitcom, Ignacio?
Well, hello. mostly there was a few things that actually inspired me. One of them, I'm a big fan of that show, Friends.
Friends.
I'm pretty sure.
Classic.
Most people have seen that
show. If they're not, they're not American. Gosh
right.
darn it.
And, I loved it when it was running in the 90s and early 2000s and stuff. And when I started watching reruns of it, I noticed something. Most people are of white ethnic background in the show. And it's a show that is set in New York. And that seemed a little unrealistic to me. Even the background people seem like white people. So, like, this is not realistic. This is not something that is currently going on and stuff. Doing a little research, it's like New York has the most variety of accents that you can find. And you don't have to go that far. Here in Georgia, you find people from all over the world.
Right, go to Clarkston, the most diverse county in the country.
Yes. So, that was part of the inspiration. It was like, well, I'm an immigrant myself. I have an accent of my own, so why not explore that? So yeah, that was part of it.
So you went to the web. Getting funding for a TV show or film is not easy, certainly. Did you pitch this idea to production companies first or television companies before going the independent route?
No.
You just went straight to the web?
Yes. Well, this is what happens. I actually got in contact with a couple of studios, and I pitched the idea, and it actually happened what you normally hear is like, oh, it's a fantastic idea, but we are kind of not interested right now. So I just decided, well, okay, if they don't want to do it for us, then I'll do it myself. And I got, at the time, I was getting together with a group on a meetup group, and it was about filming. And we decided, hey, you know, we have people here, we can do it. I mean, maybe we need to learn a few things along the way, but we can do it ourselves. So that's what.
So Rita, what's your character like?
Oh, Niambri, I love her. She actually came from Kenya to America to go through nursing school, and she's very strong-willed. She's hardworking. She loves hard. She loves her friends. She loves helping them going through any struggles or problems they have. Usually, when people have any problems, they run to Niambri because she can talk with them through it, or you know, help them, and she just loves really hard.
So you're from Nigeria, but you play a woman who's Kenyan.
Yes.
And is there, do you put on a Kenyan accent?
I typically use my Nigerian accent, but some words I change a little bit to sound more Kenyan. I don't know. I can't really explain it. The accents are very similar, but then there's some things you say like a Nigerian would say that a Kenyan typically won't say or would say differently.
Well, I'm asking because the whole theory of the show is accents, right? It's
right,
all about
exactly.
That. And I think many people who are unaware of those will just think, oh, African or
right.
Central American or South yeah. American or Latino or something like that.
Right.
How about for you, Shakeb? What's your character?
I play a character. His name is Anwar. He's from the Middle East, specifically from Lebanon. And I love my character because it kind of like resonates with myself. He comes to this country, you know, he's new to the whole world, and he's always like ridiculed about where he's from, the whole Middle Eastern stereotypes. But my character, he's like a lovable character. He loves to have fun. He's a ladies' man, but he fails at it. He has so much confidence, but he's oblivious to everything. But he's just an overall fun guy. Has parents back home that has a business, and they just help him live in this country he comes to. And it's good. It's like the show itself gives a whole dynamic of kind of gives you like a bird's eye view on how other races are perceived. Like, you know, we're not all just crazy people, you know?
Well, we do see a lot of stereotypical roles on television. You know,
right.
The Asian character is typically a
Absolutely.
Math science nerd, or the token black person, or the loud Latino woman. So how do you overcome typecasting in these roles?
Well, typecasting, if we show more of dynamics, if we show more that we could actually do more than just what we're capable of just because of our background. Like, we could also, we could play the main roles. We could play lead roles. We could play doctor, lawyers. It's just, doesn't necessarily have to be just one specific thing because we're so stereotyped. Like, for example, for like Middle Eastern people, we're like known for like being like engineers or doctors, kind of like Indians in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more we could do. You know, there's entertainment, there's radio, there's a magazine, there's photography, you know, there's a lot of other things. And that's what the show is trying to do. It's trying to like open up a broad spectrum from all different races, because we have Koreans, we have Kenyan, British and all that. It's just showing a whole different dynamic. It opens up every character to a whole different world, especially in today's era of how the world is going right now. So,
well, and this is interesting, right? Today, when the action movies Lucy came out or Wonder Woman, people were like, oh, gee, female protagonists can sell movie tickets. Mm-hmm. You know, who'd have thunk it? Or Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther came out and came cascades of articles. Surprised that minority leads can carry movies. Does the industry or the public drive the idea that white male actors are needed to sell a movie or a TV show?
I guess it's a balance. I mean, before, I want to say, you know, with all due respect, maybe years ago, there was that image of just, you know, the all-American type have to, like, sell the show. But now we have so much similarities now. despite our races, we have so much similarity that we could all bring the same thing to the table, maybe with our own unique characteristics. So I believe that, you know, different nationalities can bring different variety to the table, and we could all work as one, you know, grow like that.
I just hearing where you were about to go with that, I think, is there this idea that you are representative of all immigrants? You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know, Rita or Ignacio, if you feel that way either. You know that when somebody talks to you about the immigrant experience, do you feel like you have to represent everybody?
No.
Yeah. No, I don't. Yeah.
No. There's a joke that my fiance and I run a lot. It's like, so that guy's name is Juan. Do you know him? It's like, well, do you think all Mexicans know each other and stuff?
Right.
And
so are you called upon to represent?
So I'm like, well, I identify with this guy because we're from the same place and we probably had similar experiences. However, I'm an individual with my own personal experiences and my own thoughts and my own dreams and goals and all that stuff. And that's what we want to project with the show is like, yes, these people are from Mexico, Kenya, whatever. But they have their own ambitions. They have their own things, and they don't have to fit with like you said before, with a loud Latina woman. We have a Mexican character. Her name is Maria, and she is not like that at all. We have a Trinidadian. I'm sorry, Trinidadian character, and. They are notorious for being really, really loud and really expressive and stuff. And we make him so, even though he is still a representation of that culture, he is not necessarily what anyone will think of him for being from Trinidad. So that's what we're trying to do. Kind of break stereotypes, but at the same time, it's like, it's something familiar. It's like,
archetypes, right.
Right.
And that's Ignacio Arreola Vidal. He's the creator of the web series called Accents. Also with us are Shakeb Sikander. He's an actor in the series, and Rita Omashane. Which reminds me, okay, so this is an interesting thing. I've been in radio for a long time. I've always had these pronouncers for different kind of names and tried to do them well. Often when I'm reading them, I think, don't mess up on that, don't mess up on that, don't mess up on that. There's a kind of sensitivity to that. But there's also a paradigm, you know, the I guess it was called broadcast English for a long time. So you're breaking down, you know, not just the personal, not just the first response that someone hears to an accent, but a whole shift in thinking about the way we approach language. And I wondered about that, you know, how does that strike you as you're going out into the world? Do you feel like you have to say your name 4 or 5 times?
For me, yes, I go through that every single day. I actually went through that yesterday evening. For example, when someone asks my name, I am almost like automatically want to say Rita O'Matson because that's how it's seen and spelled.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the correct pronunciation is Rita O'Mashane.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, it's just like, oh, where are you from? And it's like an automatic thinking, like, you know, it's because of like my name looks so unique that I'm automatically from somewhere else. And I've tried to break that habit a little bit of actually pronouncing my name correctly instead of how people want me to say it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm not trying to hide my culture or my background, my ethnicity. But at the same time, it's like, especially with the show Accents, it breaks that habit. You don't have to hide yourself. You don't have to hide where you're from. You don't have to hide that you're an immigrant. And that show, the show, like, actually presents that in a positive way.
Well, when I speak, people say, you're not from Georgia. But I don't consider that insulting. It's benign. It's a benign observation, and it's an opportunity for a conversation. Well, where are you from? How does that feel to you?
Well, I have this issue, believe it or not, it's going to sound really, really weird, but with Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I go to Starbucks and I order a drink, they're like, what's your name? I'll be like, Shakeeb. Like, what? I'm like, oh, just Mario. I just say Mario. I'm like, Mario. But, like, I have no issue with it. You know, like, it's, I agree. I mean, for people to, like, read, like, you know, like, say other people's names in a different way, it's kind of hard because it could be pronounced in so many different ways. But you know, like, it's, with my name, it means peace. So, you know, if you were to say it if you were to say it in a slightly different way, it'll give it a whole different meaning. So, for myself, it's, I mean, it's just a eye opener because how should I say this exactly? I mean, like with this show, in my relationship to my character as well, it kind of opens up this different idea. It's like you're selling a stereotype with humor in a way.
Well, yes, yeah. It's a sitcom, but humor also sells. Features some very serious immigrants, issues that immigrants face. So how do you create satire or comedy for these very real-world problems?
That's a good question. It's a really good question.
Well, some of the episodes are based on real-life experiences, not necessarily happening to me or to one of our writers, but... it's more like observations of what happened to someone close to me, and then I try to put him in and give him that comedic twist. That's what we want to do. It's like, well, it's all not that serious, but you know, it can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, several shows like Insecure that are very big now started on YouTube. Is there more freedom to write for a web series?
Yeah,
does everybody write it together, or how do you do it? They're just writers, and then you guys do the scripts?
No, we have a group of writers, and we just get together pretty much every week. We go through a script, and we polish it. Someone writes whatever they think that it's funny, and then we just go through it and polish it and make it, like, super funny.
Okay, you polish it like that. You have a couple videos posted on YouTube.
Right.
Does anybody, do you get recognized by any chance, Jacob or Rita, for being in the series?
Actually, so far my family have seen it, and a couple of my friends from my old college I went to, but they're like, hey, we saw you in a bunny suit. I'm like, oh, it's a long story, man. You just type my name and you see me in a bunny suit. Like, okay, it's a long story.
How about for you, Rita?
Yes. Actually, a couple of my friends, they've gone to YouTube and they just like type my name in, and they're like, Rita, you know, I saw a couple videos of you through Atlanta Cinemaniacs. And I'm like, wait, what?
So what kind of feedback are you getting for the series?
Oh, they like, all my friends love it. They feel like that's a great idea. Like,
how about beyond the friends? What kind of do you know who's watching?
Oh, like,
I mean, online you can tell a little bit about somebody. I just wondered if anybody has commented, and you feel like you're reaching your community.
There is one person. He's a personnel in the show called The Dish Nation. His name is Gary with the T. If he's listening to this, but yeah, he's. I told him about the project, and he's one of my viewers, one of my fans, I guess.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck on it, and we do have a link to see more episodes of Accents. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
That's Ignacio Arreola Vidal, Rita Omashane.
Yes.
How'd I do? And Shakeb Sikander, thank you. Then that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer. Don Smith is our Dean of Grammar, and Amy Kiley, our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. See you tomorrow.